Gerard Dow knew nothing of the attachment which had sprung up between his pupil and his niece, and even if he had, it is doubtful whether he would have regarded its existence as any serious obstruction to the wishes of Mynheer Vanderhausen. Marriages were then and there matters of traffic and calculation, and it would have appeared as absurd in the eyes of the guardian to make a mutual attachment an essential element in a contract of the sort as it would have been to draw up his bonds and receipts in the language of romance. The painter, however, did not communicate to his niece the important step which he had taken in her behalf, a forbearance caused not by any anticipated opposition on her part, but solely by a ludicrous consciousness that if she were to ask him for a description of her destined bridegroom, he would be forced to confess that he had not once seen his face, and if called upon, would find it absolutely impossible to identify him. On the next day, Gerard Dow, after dinner, called his niece to him, and having scanned her person with an air of satisfaction, he took her hand, and looking upon her pretty, innocent face with a smile of kindness, he said, "Rose, my girl, that face of yours will make your fortune." Rose blushed and smiled. Such faces and such tempers seldom go together, and when they do, the compound is a love charm. Few heads or hearts can resist. Trust me, you will soon be a bride, girl. But this is trifling, and I am pressed for time, so make ready the large room by 8 o'clock tonight, and give directions for supper at 9. I expect a friend, and observe me, child, do you trick yourself out handsomely. I will not have him think us poor or sluttish." With these words he left her, and took his way to the room in which his pupils worked. When the evening closed in, Gerard called Schalken, who was about to take his departure to his own obscure and comfortless lodgings, and asked him to come home and sup with Rose and Vanderhausen. The invitation was, of course, accepted, and Gerard Dow and his pupil soon found themselves in the handsome and, even then, antique chamber which had been prepared for the reception of the stranger. A cheerful wood fire blazed in the hearth, a little at one side of which an old-fashioned table, which shone in the firelight like burnished gold, was awaiting the supper, for which preparations were going forward. And ranged with exact regularity stood the tall-backed chairs, whose ungracefulness was more than compensated by their comfort. The little party, consisting of Rose, her uncle, and the artist, awaited the arrival of the expected visitor with considerable impatience. 9 o'clock at length came, and with it a summons at the street door, which being speedily answered, was followed by a slow and emphatic tread upon the staircase. The steps moved heavily across the lobby. The door of the room in which the party we have described were assembled slowly opened, and there entered a figure which startled, almost appalled, the phlegmatic Dutchman, and nearly made Rose scream with terror. It was the form, and arrayed in the garb of Mynheer Vanderhausen. The air, the gait, the height were the same, but the features had never been seen by any of the party before. The stranger stopped at the door of the room, and displayed his form and face completely. He wore a dark-colored cloth cloak, which was short and full, not falling quite to his knees. His legs were cased in dark purple silk stockings, and his shoes were adorned with roses of the same color. The opening of the cloak in front showed the undersuit to consist of some very dark, perhaps sable, material, and his hands were enclosed in a pair of heavy leather gloves, which ran up considerably above the wrist, in the manner of a gauntlet. In one hand he carried his walking-stick and his hat, which he had removed, and the other hung heavily by his side. A quantity of grizzled hair descended in long tresses from his head, and rested upon the plates of a stiff ruff which effectually concealed his neck. So far all was well, but the face, all the flesh of the face was colored with the bluish leaden hue which is sometimes produced by metallic medicines administered in excessive quantities. The eyes showed an undue proportion of muddy white, and had a certain indefinable character of insanity. The hue of the lips bearing the usual relation to that of the face was, consequently, nearly black, and the entire character of the face was sensual, malignant, and even satanic. It was remarkable that the worshipful stranger suffered as little as possible of his flesh to appear, and that during his visit he did not once remove his gloves. Having stood for some moments at the door, Drardow at length found breath and collectedness to bid him welcome, and with a mute inclination of the head, the stranger stepped forward into the room. There was something indescribably odd, even horrible, about all his motions, something undefinable, that was unnatural, unhuman. It was as if the limbs were guided and directed by a spirit unused to the management of bodily machinery. The stranger spoke hardly at all during his visit, which did not exceed half an hour, and the host himself could scarcely muster courage enough to utter the few necessary salutations and courtesies. And, indeed, such was the nervous terror which the presence of Vanderhausen inspired, that very little would have made all his entertainers fly in downright panic from the room. They had not so far lost all self-possession, however, as to fail to observe two strange peculiarities of their visitor. During his stay, his eyelids did not once close, or, indeed, move in the slightest degree, and farther, there was a death-like stillness in his whole person, owing to the absence of the heaving motion of the chest caused by the process of respiration. These two peculiarities, though when told they may appear trifling, produced a very striking and unpleasant effect when seen and observed. Vanderhausen at length relieved the painter of Leiden of his inauspicious presence, and with no trifling sense of relief the little party heard the street door close after him. "Dear uncle," said Rose, "what a frightful man! I would not see him again for the wealth of the States." "Tush, foolish girl," said Dow, whose sensations were anything but comfortable. "A man may be as ugly as the devil, and yet, if his heart and actions are good, he is worth all the pretty-faced perfumed puppies that walk the mall. Rose, my girl, it is very true he has not thy pretty face, but I know him to be wealthy and liberal. And were he 10 times more ugly, these 2 virtues would be enough to counterbalance all his deformity, and if not sufficient actually to alter the shape and hue of his features, at least enough to prevent one thinking them so much amiss." "Do you know, uncle," said Rose, "when I saw him standing at the door, I could not get it out of my head that I saw the old painted wooden figure that used to frighten me so much in the church of St. Lawrence at Rotterdam." Gerard laughed, though he could not help inwardly acknowledging the justness of the comparison. He was resolved, however, as far as he could, to check his niece's disposition to dilate upon the ugliness of her intended bridegroom, although he was not a little pleased as well as puzzled to observe that she appeared totally exempt from that mysterious dread of the stranger which, he could not disguise it from himself, considerably affected him, as also his pupil Godfrey Schalken. Early on the next day there arrived, from various quarters of the town, rich presents of silks, velvets, jewelry, and so forth, for Rose, and also a packet directed to Gerard Dow, which on being opened was found to contain a contract of marriage, formally drawn up, between Wilken Vanderhausen of the Boom Quay in Rotterdam and Rose Velderkaust of Leiden, niece to Gerard Dow, master in the art of painting, also of the same city, and containing engagements on the part of Vanderhausen to make settlements upon his bride, far more splendid than he had before led her guardian to believe likely, and which were to be secured to her use in the most unexceptionable manner possible, the money being placed in the hand of Gerard Dow himself. I have no sentimental scenes to describe, no cruelty of guardians, no magnanimity of wards, no agonies or transport of lovers. The record I have to make is one of sordidness, levity, and heartlessness. In less than a week after the first interview, which we have just described, the contract of marriage was fulfilled, and Schalken saw the prize which he would have risked existence to secure carried off in solemn pomp by his repulsive rival. For 2 or 3 days he absented himself from the school. He then returned and worked, if with less cheerfulness, with far more dogged resolution than before. The stimulus of love had given place to that of ambition. Months passed away, and, contrary to his expectation, and, indeed, to the direct promise of the parties, Gerard Dow heard nothing of his niece or her worshipful spouse. The interest of the money, which was to have been demanded in quarterly sums, lay unclaimed in his hands. He began to grow extremely uneasy. Mynheer Vanderhausen's direction in Rotterdam he was fully possessed of. After some irresolution he finally determined to journey thither, a trifling undertaking, and easily accomplished, and thus to satisfy himself of the safety and comfort of his ward, for whom he entertained an honest and strong affection. His search was in vain, however. No one in Rotterdam had ever heard of Mynheer Vanderhausen. Gerard Dow left not a house in the Boom Quay untried, but all in vain. No one could give him any information whatever regarding the object of his inquiry, and he was obliged to return to Leyden nothing wiser, and far more anxious than when he had left it. On his arrival, he hastened to the establishment from which Vanderhausen had hired the lumbering, though, considering the times, most luxurious vehicle which the bridal party had employed to convey them to Rotterdam. From the driver of this machine he learned that, having proceeded by slow stages, they had late in the evening approached Rotterdam, but that before they entered the city, and while yet nearly a mile from it, a small party of men, soberly clad, and after the old fashion, with peaked beards and mustaches, standing in the center of the road, obstructed the further progress of the carriage. The driver reined in his horses, much fearing, from the obscurity of the hour and the loneliness of the road, that some mischief was intended. His fears were, however, somewhat allayed by his observing that these strange men carried a large litter of an antique shape, and which they immediately set down upon the pavement, whereupon the bridegroom, having opened the coach door from within, descended, and having assisted his bride to do likewise, led her, weeping bitterly and wringing her hands, to the litter, which they both entered. It was then raised by the men who surrounded it, and speedily carried towards the city, and before it had proceeded very far, the darkness concealed it from the view of the Dutch coachman. In the inside of the vehicle he found a purse, whose contents more than thrice paid the hire of the carriage and man. He saw and could tell nothing more of Mynheer Vanderhausen and his beautiful lady. This mystery was a source of profound anxiety and even grief to Gerard Dow. There was evidently fraud in the dealing of Vanderhausen with him, though for what purpose committed he could not imagine. He greatly doubted how far it was possible for a man possessing such a countenance to be anything but a villain, and every day that passed without his hearing from or of his niece, instead of inducing him to forget his fears, on the contrary, tended more and more to aggravate them. The loss of her cheerful society tended also to depress his spirits, and in order to dispel the gloom which often crept upon his mind after his daily occupations were over, he was wont frequently to ask Schalken to accompany him home and share his otherwise solitary supper. One evening, the painter and his pupil were sitting by the fire, having accomplished a comfortable meal, and had yielded to the silent and delicious melancholy of digestion, when their ruminations were disturbed by a loud sound at the street door, as if occasioned by some person rushing and scrambling vehemently against it. A domestic had run without delay to ascertain the cause of the disturbance, and they heard him twice or thrice interrogate the applicant for admission, but without eliciting any other answer but a sustained reiteration of sounds. They heard him then open the hall door, and immediately there followed a light and rapid tread on the staircase. Schalken advanced towards the door. It opened before he reached it, and Rose rushed into the room. She looked wild, fierce and haggard with terror and exhaustion, but her dress surprised them as much as even her unexpected appearance. It consisted of a kind of white woolen wrapper, made close about the neck, and descending to the very ground. It was much deranged and travel-soiled. The poor creature had hardly entered the chamber when she fell senseless on the floor. With some difficulty, they succeeded in reviving her, and on recovering her senses, she instantly exclaimed in a tone of terror rather than mere impatience, "Wine! Wine! Quickly, or I'm lost!" Astonished and almost scared at the strange agitation in which the call was made, they at once administered to her wishes, and she drank some wine with a haste and eagerness which surprised them. She had hardly swallowed it when she exclaimed with the same urgency, "Food, for God's sake, food, at once, or I perish!" A considerable fragment of a roast joint was upon the table, and Schalken immediately began to cut some, but he was anticipated, for no sooner did she see it than she caught it, a more than mortal image of famine, and with her hands and even with her teeth she tore off the flesh and swallowed it. When the paroxysm of hunger had been a little appeased, she appeared on a sudden overcome with shame, or it may have been that other more agitating thoughts overpowered and scared her, for she began to weep bitterly and to wring her hands. "Oh, send for a minister of God," said she. "I am not safe till he comes. Send for him speedily." Gerard Dow dispatched a messenger instantly, and prevailed on his niece to allow him to surrender his bedchamber to her use. He also persuaded her to retire to it at once to rest. Her consent was extorted upon the condition that they would not leave her for a moment. "Oh, that the holy man were here," she said. "He can deliver me. The dead and the living can never be one. God has forbidden it." With these mysterious words she surrendered herself to their guidance, and they proceeded to the chamber which Gerard Dow had assigned to her use. Do not leave me for a moment," said she. "I am lost forever if you do." Gerard Dow's chamber was approached through a spacious apartment, which they were now about to enter. He and Shalkin each carried a candle, so that a sufficiency of light was cast upon all surrounding objects. They were now entering the large chamber, which, as I have said, communicated with Dow's apartment, when Rose suddenly stopped, and, in a whisper which thrilled them both with horror, she said, "Oh God, he is here! He is here! See! See, there he goes!" She pointed towards the door of the inner room, and Shalkin thought he saw a shadowy and ill-defined form gliding into that apartment. He drew his sword, and, raising the candle so as to throw its light with increased distinctness upon the objects in the room, he entered the chamber into which the shadow had glided. No figure was there, nothing but the furniture which belonged to the room, and yet he could not be deceived as to the fact that something had moved before them into the chamber. A sickening dread came upon him, and the cold perspiration broke out in the heavy drops upon his forehead. Nor was he more composed when he heard the increased urgency and agony of entreaty with which Rose implored them not to leave her for a moment. "I saw him," said she. "He's here. I cannot be deceived. I know him. He's by me. He is with me. He's in the room. Then, for God's sake, as you would save me, do not stir from beside me." They at length prevailed upon her to lie down upon the bed, where she continued to urge them to stay by her. She frequently uttered incoherent sentences, repeating again and again, "The dead and the living cannot be one, God has forbidden it," and then again, "Rest to the wakeful, sleep to the sleepwalkers." These and such mysterious and broken sentences she continued to utter until the clergyman arrived. Gerard Dow began to fear, naturally enough, that terror or ill-treatment had unsettled the poor girl's intellect, and he half suspected, by the suddenness of her appearance, the unseasonableness of the hour, and above all, from the wildness and terror of her manner, that she had made her escape from some place of confinement for lunatics, and was in imminent fear of pursuit. He resolved to summon medical advice as soon as the mind of his niece had been in some measure set at rest by the offices of the clergyman, whose attendance she had so earnestly desired, and until this object had been attained, he did not venture to put any questions to her, which might possibly, by reviving painful or horrible recollections, increase her agitation. The clergyman soon arrived, a man of ascetic countenance and venerable age, one whom Gerard Dow respected very much, forasmuch as he was a veteran polemic, though one perhaps more dreaded as a combatant than beloved as a Christian, of pure morality, subtle brain, and frozen heart. He entered the chamber which communicated with that in which Rose reclined, and immediately on his arrival she requested him to pray for her, as for one who lay in the hands of Satan, and who could hope for deliverance only from heaven. That you may distinctly understand all the circumstances of the event which I am going to describe, it is necessary to state the relative position of the parties who were engaged in it. The old clergyman and Shalkin were in the anteroom of which I have already spoken. Rose lay in the inner chamber, the door of which was open, and by the side of the bed, at her urgent desire, stood her guardian. A candle burned in the bedchamber, and three were lighted in the outer apartment. The old man cleared his voice as if about to commence, but before he had time to begin, a sudden gust of air blew out the candle which served to illuminate the room in which the poor girl lay, and she, with hurried alarm, exclaimed, "Godfrey, bring in another candle. The darkness is unsafe." Gerard Dow, forgetting for the moment her repeated injunctions, in the immediate impulse, stepped from the bedchamber into the other in order to supply what she desired.
"Oh, God, do not go, dear uncle," shrieked the unhappy girl,
and at the same time she sprung from the bed and darted after him in order, by her grasp, to detain him. But the warning came too late, for scarcely had he passed the threshold and hardly had his niece had time to utter the startling exclamation when the door which divided the two rooms closed violently after him, as if swung by a strong blast of wind. Shalkin and he both rushed to the door, but their united and desperate efforts could not avail so much as to shake it. Shriek after shriek burst from the inner chamber with all the piercing loudness of despairing terror. Shalkin and Dow applied every nerve to force upon the door, but all in vain. There was no sound of struggling from within, but the screams seemed to increase in loudness, and at the same time they heard the bolts of the lattice window withdrawn, and the window itself grated upon the sill as if thrown open. One last shriek, so long and piercing and agonized as to be scarcely human, swelled from the room, and suddenly there followed a death-like silence. A light step was heard crossing the floor, as if from the bed to the window, and almost at the same instant the door gave way, and, yielding to the pressure of the external applicants, nearly precipitated them into the room. It was empty. The window was open, and Shalkin sprung to a chair and gazed out upon the street and canal below. He saw no form, but he saw, or thought he saw, the waters of the broad canal beneath settling ring after ring in heavy circles, as if a moment before disturbed by the submission of some ponderous body. No trace of Rose was ever after found, nor was anything certain respecting her mysterious wooer discovered or even suspected. No clue, whereby to trace the intricacies of the labyrinth and to arrive at its solution, presented itself. But an incident occurred, which, though it will not be received by our rational readers, in lieu of evidence, produced nevertheless a strong and a lasting impression upon the mind of Shalkin. Many years after the events which we have detailed, Shalkin, then residing far away, received an intimation of his father's death and of his intended burial upon a fixed day in the church of Rotterdam. It was necessary that a very considerable journey should be performed by the funeral procession, which, as it will be readily believed, was not very numerously attended. Shalkin with difficulty arrived in Rotterdam late in the day upon which the funeral was appointed to take place. It had not then arrived. Evening closed in, and still it did not appear. Shalkin strolled down to the church. He found it open. Notice of the arrival of the funeral had been given, and the vault in which the body was to be laid had been opened. The sexton, on seeing a well-dressed gentleman, whose object was to attend the expected obsequies, pacing the aisle of the church, hospitably invited him to share with him the comforts of a blazing fire, which, as was his custom in wintertime upon such occasions, he had kindled in the hearth of a chamber in which he was accustomed to await the arrival of such grisly guests, and which communicated, by a flight of steps, with the vault below. In this chamber, Shalkin and his entertainer seated themselves, and the sexton, after some fruitless attempts to engage his guest in conversation, was obliged to apply himself to his tobacco pipe and can to solace his solitude. In spite of his grief and cares, the fatigues of a rapid journey of nearly 40 hours gradually overcame the mind and body of Godfrey Shalkin, and he sank into a deep sleep, from which he awakened by someone's shaking him gently by the shoulder. He first thought that the old sexton had called him, but he was no longer in the room. He roused himself, and as soon as he could clearly see what was around him, he perceived a female form, clothed in a kind of light robe of white, part of which was so disposed as to form a veil, and in her hand she carried a lamp. She was moving rather away from him, in the direction of the flight of steps which conducted towards the vaults. Shalkin felt a vague alarm at the sight of this figure, and at the same time an irresistible impulse to follow its guidance. He followed it towards the vaults, but when it reached the head of the stairs he paused. The figure paused also, and, turning gently round, displayed, by the light of the lamp it carried, the face and features of his first love, Rose Velderkaust. There was nothing horrible, or even sad, in the countenance. On the contrary, it wore the same arch smile which used to enchant the artist long before in his happy days. A feeling of awe and interest, too intense to be resisted, prompted him to follow the spectre, if spectre it were. She descended the stairs, he followed, and turning to the left, through a narrow passage, she led him, to his infinite surprise, into what appeared to be an old-fashioned Dutch apartment, such as the pictures of Gerard Dow have served to immortalize. Abundance of costly antique furniture was disposed about the room, and in one corner stood a four-post bed, with heavy black cloth curtains around it. The figure frequently turned towards him with the same arch smile, and when she came to the side of the bed, she drew the curtains, and, by the light of the lamp, which she held towards its contents, she disclosed to the horror-stricken painter, sitting bolt upright in the bed, the livid and demoniac form of Vanderhausen. Schalken had hardly seen him when he fell senseless upon the floor, where he lay until discovered on the next morning by persons employed in closing the passages into the vaults. He was lying in a cell of considerable size, which had not been disturbed for a long time, and he had fallen beside a large coffin, which was supported upon small pillars, a security against attacks of vermin. To his dying day, Schalken was satisfied of the reality of the vision which he had witnessed, and he has left behind him a curious evidence of the impression which it wrought upon his fancy, in a painting executed shortly after the event I have narrated, and which is valuable as exhibiting not only the peculiarities which have made Schalken's pictures sought after, but even more so, as presenting a portrait of his early love, Rose Velderkaust, whose mysterious fate must always remain matter of speculation. End of Schalken the Painter by J. Sheridan LaFanu.